Είστε παρέα με το SBS Ελληνικά. Βρείτε περισσότερες ενδιαφέρουσες ιστορίες στο sbs.com.au/greek.
Ακούτε το ελληνικό πρόγραμμα της SBS. Είμαι η Ντίνα Γερολίμου και σήμερα κοντά μας έχουμε την συγγραφέα Karen Martin για να συζητήσουμε για το τελευταίο της βιβλίο. You're listening to SBS Greek. I'm Dina Gerolimou, and today with me in the studio, I have the author, the novelist, Karen Martin. Welcome to SBS Greek, Karen.
Thank you, Dina. Lovely to be here.
You're here to discuss your latest book, your most recent book, which is called Delphi. This is the third book in the series Women Unveiled. And it is, I understand, a sequel to the first book, Dancing the Labyrinth. So Greece is a source of inspiration
for you. Much so, very much so.
Tell us about Delphi. How did this book come about?
Delphi, well, it is a sequel, but you can read it standalone. I've written it in such a way. But it follows on from the story that was set up in Dancing the Labyrinth, which was about Cressida. And the main sort of thrust of that story was that she's from a dysfunctional home base, that's of domestic violence, and she becomes pregnant. And so during the course of the novel, she has to grapple with the, you know, what am I going to do? Am I going to be having this baby that will then continue the bloodline of my father, the violent traits, the violence in the DNA, and then through the realization, it's like, well, she never had mothering; she has no model. So that's sort of the interweaving of what happens with Dancing the Labyrinth. She meets Angela, who is this wonderful, wise Greek woman. So at the end of the story of Dancing the Labyrinth, we're not quite sure what she's going to do. Delphi begins 4 years later. She has decided to keep the baby. And whilst I actually thought I was writing about the Oracle of Delphi, the way that the book unfolds and evolves is that Cressida, she goes through a generational healing. She doesn't want to be her mother or father incarnate to her son. And then also through her questioning what she wants to do and who is she in this world, she learns more about her own mother's journey. And ultimately, I guess it's all about, you know, moving forward, how do we heal trauma? And a lot of that is about a forgiveness of self, forgiveness of our own shame, etc.
What are the main themes of the book? You mentioned one, which is trauma and healing. This is one of the main themes. What other themes are there, and how are they connected to the Oracle of Delphi?
Yes, the nice question. Thank you, Dina. The theme of trauma was actually something like it evolved. I didn't plan to write a book on healing or trauma. What I wanted to do and what I like to do with my writing is to look at women's stories and to bring them back to the fore. So in terms of Cressida, I was wanting to put her into a situation where life had become really good, but then we are offered, in our patriarchal society, we're offered things like, oh, marriage as the be-all and end-all. Society is created for coupledom. And if not, it's marriage. It could be money. So these are those sort of temptations that that we aspire to. I mean, we want to live a good life. We want to live a happy life. So I wanted to see what Cressida would do in that situation. So that's a major theme of looking at what is set up within the realms of what is acceptable or available for women and what does this protagonist do. The actual story of the Oracle is interwoven because she has this connection with from Dancing the Labyrinth, a Minoan priestess, Ashtar. I plant that seed in Dancing the Labyrinth, where she is to become the first oracle setting up in Delphi, which at the time was called Pytho. Pytho, my Greek is happy for you to correct me on any of my Greek. And that was originally set up 500 years before Apollo, and that was set up as a sanctuary for Gaia. And when I had worked on that story of Ashtar and her connection to Cressida, That's when I realized it was like, oh, hang on a minute, there's 500 years yet to go. So it took me on my own little journey. And there were certain things I didn't know and things that I researched, things that I learned, things that I still don't know, and I've never found an answer. So I'd be very interested if any of your listeners knew. But
like what?
In Delphi, the first temple that is built is to Athena. It's around the corner from it. You know, the Delphi's all the ruins are on the hill. You've got the spring, and then you've got
And it's circular, right? That's the one, Athena Pronea.
It's the Tholos.
And you speak a bit of Greek too.
Very, very little, very little. yes, and I love that and felt the power of that. And so I tried to work out and research and ask people and, you know, I spent time in Itaia. Is that how I pronounce it?
Correct, Itaia.
Itaia. I spent time there just to get the feel of that. You know, why did Athena, why was that temple there first? I couldn't find anything. So being in the site, being the way the story evolved and is created, I actually, I believe the muses are there. And this story, it sounds pretty reasonable to me.
You mentioned you went to Delphi and you went to Itaia. So you explored that place where the main character of the book of Delphi, Cressida, goes to Delphi. In Dancing the Labyrinth, you went to Crete and you stayed there for a bit. That's where the book and the story unfolded. So I can see a pattern here. You going to Greece, not only to seek inspiration, but to find the stories. And somehow they are linked with the ancient world, right? Is this correct?
Absolutely. It's my work has always... I've always been involved in theatre and writing and things like that. And the best work I do is site-specific work. And I go there and I've actually looked into it because a year ago I came across this neurodivergent, on the spectrum, I don't know what it's called. It's like a neurodivergency. It's called aphantasia. And or listeners, let's play a game. Okay, so listeners, if you close your eyes and imagine an apple, and so you can see the apple, turn it around in your eyes, maybe put it on a table. Okay, open your eyes. And so what did you see? What colour was your apple? You know, was it bright and shiny? Was there a worm in it? You know, a little stalk or a leaf? You know? I can't do that. I have what's called aphantasia, which means I have a very limited visual recall. So memories are very difficult for me. Aristotle recognised that imagination is vital to be able to be cognizant. But there's a lot of research now that's actually saying, well, if you've got this aphantasia and one in five of the population have it, then you may have a heightened modality in something else. And my modality is that felt sense. I go to a place and I'm sitting here and I know you can't see me out there in Radio Land, but I'm rubbing my thumb across my fingers. I feel things and I don't feel them touch-wise. I feel them intuitively. I feel them through dreams. It's a felt sense that is heightened. So when I go to when I went to Itaia to do the research, so part of that was I wanted to walk where the pilgrims walked up from Kira up to Delphi, which I did do. I was really uncomfortable with Itaia. I was really uncomfortable. I was at one point I was curled up on my bed, almost crying, but just curled up on my bed, going, "What am I doing here? I want to go home." And I'm thinking, "I'm in Greece. Why would I want to go home?" Like. How crazy. But it just was, it was so uncomfortable. And so I went round, further around the road, the coastline, and went to and found Galaxidi, which is just beautiful. And I could see Delphi from Galaxidi. And the light comes and shines on it. It's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And then in my research, I discovered that Apollo cursed Itaia. Now, did I feel that? I don't know. But I wasn't comfortable there. Apollo cursed them because the Athenians, it's all wrapped up with the sacred war, and I know that there's people out there who know a lot more than the sacred war than I do, because I haven't dug into that sort of history of that particular event. But Apollo cursed Ithia because they ate the sheep that he had put in the plains for the Cretan priests who were to look after the oracle. And when the Athenians had planted the olive grove, they ate and killed all the sheep, and therefore the curse. So I cannot say outrightly, oh, I felt that. No, but I find it really interesting that I was uncomfortable. I did not know why. And then I come across this story in my research. So that's sort of when I went to Crete to write Dancing the Labyrinth. I had no idea about the Minoans, but the story could only have been told there.
Cressida, the main character in Dancing the Labyrinth and Delphi, time travels. She's got this ability through dreaming, through intuition, through senses. You know, she goes to a different space and time. And that was very clear in Dancing the Labyrinth. She does it in Delphi as well. And through this time travel, that's how I read it. Through this time travel, she actually builds a bridge. And on that road, she finds answers. Is this how you planned it?
I love your questions, Dina. Love it. I always love it too, in that I think everything we read or everything we look at or art or things like that, it all, I believe, always says more about us than the actual what's there. It's fascinating. So I love questions like this that make me think, oh, wow, you know. When I wrote it, I created this connection between Ashtar and Cressida. They're separated by time. And when we first meet Ashtar, it's in a dream of Cressida's. And she sees herself as a young, dark-haired child, which is Ashtar. So I'm playing with that magical realism that they are one and the same. And it's a connection of through time. So it's time travel in a way, but not a concrete way, because it's going into the self. And so I guess you could see that also in psychological terms. I mean, I see it that Ashtar was real and this happened, but I guess you could also see that Ashtar is through a portal, another self of Cressida. But I haven't examined that way yet.
Is it a chain through generations and through centuries and millennia? We see a connection in your book between women, only that the women of today, like Cressida, is very much focused on her life. But the women of ancient Greece, they focus more on the community, on the divine, on the wisdom. They see themselves as keepers of wisdom as well. And I find that element fascinating. Did you mean this juxtaposition, this sort of antithesis between contemporary women and ancient women?
Again, interesting, really interesting.
Because you actually raised some questions on environment. There are some environmental questions. There are some questions on transformation, on healing, on transforming and changing in order to preserve. That's in the ancient world. But in contemporary society like Cressida and Angela, they're more concerned about what's happening in my life now.
Yeah, look, there's a whole lot of answers that are screaming like children in my head. So I'm going to go for a few of them. So first of all, I love that's what you've seen. And for me, immediately, when I was trying to learn Greek, the first difference between Greek and English is English is all about the I, you know, the ownership, the proprietor. Whereas the Greek language is all collective. You are the friend of mine. You know, you are the friend becomes first. And the Greek language is all about collective thinking. It's beautiful. It's beautiful in a way that the English language doesn't have. And I don't even know Greek language, but this is what I got from my very early lessons, which, by the way, the our neighbour had said we should get our money back because we were so bad. So, you know, but I did get that out of that too. I think with Cressida in the now, yet she's healing a generational healing as well. So she's sort of in that transition between having to look back to move forward. And I think that's a really interesting tension or dynamic.
Yeah, for me as a Greek, it's not surprising at all that you have to go back to find the answers for today and lay the foundations for tomorrow, because that's what history does. What to me was fascinating is that everything happens in Greece, and the ancient Greek world has such a strong presence and influence. The feminine power of ancient Greek women, the feminine wisdom, Mother Earth. Mother Earth is a very strong character.
Mm. Yeah.
And her wisdom comes in, Gaia, Yea, Yi, right, Earth. You are bringing together, you're weaving a tapestry, which is actually very, very rich. So as a non-Greek writer...
You're breaking my heart.
Going back to an ancient Greek world to find answers,
yeah,
I find it fascinating.
The discovering the Minoans was source of joy to me, an absolute source of joy, and I guess that's what I'm looking at with the with both books, because what we have is the transition from matriarchy to patriarchy.
And this is something you talk about in Dancing the Labyrinth.
Absolutely.
You don't touch it in Delphi, and you in Dancing the Labyrinth actually you link it with the rise in of violence and the subjugation,
yes,
of women.
Absolutely. Well, that's what patriarchy is really,
yeah,
isn't
that's
it?
True. Yeah.
but I think what is also within Delphi though is the role of Athena. She is the transition from matriarchy to patriarchy. She was born from Metis, born from Zeus. She is the transition between the heroic past and the democratic future. So her role is really, really important, and makes sense that she was an important figure in the transition from Apollo taking the claim of the oracle from the python or from Gaia, because that is, again, the patriarchy, moving into patriarchy. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, what did you find in Delphi?
Cats. I found cats. I loved it. You know what I did? And I put this into the story because I'm so naughty. I went to Delphi the first time was 2016 when I was writing Dancing the Labyrinth. And I went to both of the ruins and I really felt a connection with Athena's. It was so powerful. So I wanted to go back, and I wanted to go back when there was no one there. I just wanted to be there. And I didn't mean to break in. I thought they might be open, but they didn't. They weren't. So I did jump the fence, the gate, and I went in and I just sat there. I had some cats with me as well. And all this is, Cressida's got this little story down in her own little adventure. But just being there, you know, it just... It's so powerful.
Which part of Delphi did you break the gate?
Jump over the gate. I did not break a thing. I did not.
And I'll jump over.
I deny all charges. I deny all charges. it was the Tholos, where the Tholos is, the round one. Athena's temple down the road.
Okay.
I mean, Delphi's like a Fort Knox. You can't get in. You've got to go through everything.
It's a huge site.
It's massive. But it's the one that's around the road and down to the right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm asking because that comes as a surprise to me, because last time I was there, everything was open. There was no fence or gate or anything.
oh no, this is, well, no, there was definitely a gate and I definitely jumped over it. And it was closed, but, you know, only because I was there probably about 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning. So I'd only sort of gone about half an hour before it had opened. So it wasn't anything, you know, too naughty.
I'm asking about Delphi and what you found there when you went there, apart from the cats.
Yeah.
It's because all my friends, everyone I have come across in Australia who have gone to Delphi, they all told me the same thing. Oh, my God. The energy there is different. You can feel it.
At the Apollo Realm?
No, Delphi. Anywhere, yeah. Not specifically. They didn't give me a specific space.
Okay.
It was Delphi.
Because I found the energy very different. The one to the right down the hill, Athena's, that to me was strong and powerful and inspirational. Going up to the other one, the main one,
Where the Temple of Apollo is.
Where the Temple of Apollo is, and all the sort of treasuries and all the statues and all this sort of thing. The Rock of the Sibyl, it's fake. There was one time I did want, though, because right near it is a laurel bush. And I'm like, I just so wanted to go and pick a leaf. I must have this sort of Cretan streak in me. That's what I'm blaming it on. It wasn't as significant. I was surprised. We did have a beautiful experience because we went there with my ex-husband and his brother and his wife. And she and I had bought these little goddess gowns, goddess frocks, just the day beforehand. And so I said, oh, we have to wear them. And she's going, oh, okay. So there we were in these little, little cheesecloth goddess little frock things. And when we got to the theatre, there was nobody there. So we went. At that point, I think they've closed it off now, but at that point you could go and stand and walk up and, it was completely open. So we went on to the round stage area, the agora of it, and we danced. It was wonderful. And then these tourists come up and want their photo with us and all this sort of thing. But it was really lovely in that sort of celebration of it. Yeah, it's an amazing sight. An amazing sight.
Tell me about Angela, which is the other main character. She appears in Dancing the Labyrinth. She's the one who makes sense, who helps Cressida make sense of what's happening to her and helps her on the journey to self-discovery. So tell me about Angela, whose name comes from Angel, and she becomes Cressida's guardian angel.
Yeah, and look, I didn't question the names. Cressida's name comes from Charmian Cliff. That was a real choice. But the other names were just part of what came. And I guess in that sense that Angela is the angel. She's almost, I wanted her to be sort of that opposite to Cressida. Cressida was young and flawed and frightened and, her first instinct is to run, when in trouble, just run. So I wanted someone grounded to just balance that. And when Angela initially meets her, Cressida's incredibly traumatized, having gone through a panic attack, and it's in this storm, and it's she's just so overwhelmed. And Angela's just that calming feature, which is interesting because you don't want to make a character so two-dimensional. You don't want them just to be, you're a device. And I think the key to me in writing her came in Dancing the Labyrinth when there's earlier on the piece that Cressida and Angela have passed each other in the street or whatever, and they know of each other's presence. They don't know each other. But Cressida sees in her a deep sadness that resonates, and that sort of that connection. So that then plays out in Delphi. And that was really interesting to go, I think it is written that she's around 40. She has been married, she's got her own grief. And through her, I was actually able to explore elements of marriage and relationship, which is I wanted to juxtapose this, Cressida's looking at, oh, I may be getting married. Should I get married? You know, there's a great option for me. But I wanted to
and
say...
And that's the patriarchy coming in. Coming through. That's the patriarchy coming through.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All the research tells us that marriage suits married men. It does not suit women. Women are happier if they are single. And that's what the research has been saying ever since I started doing a thesis in, 1984 or so, looking at things. That data was there and it's still there. Nothing has counteracted that. So it's very much a patriarchal construct to control women.
There is a lot of symbolism in your novel where women, female characters, are the main characters. They're center stage. Was this deliberate? Was this a choice? Or it was subconsciously coming into the novel, entering the novel? And I'm talking about the symbolism because you have the oracle, you have the priestesses, you have Castalia's, the Castalia spring, you have Delphi itself, you have the snake, you have the serpent, you have the python. So there is a lot of symbolism there. And most of the symbols are very, very powerful. I was just wondering about the process in your mind while you were writing it.
I am very aware that women's art and women's stories and women's songs and women's healing have all been burnt or murdered or buried or hidden or beaten or, where are our stories? Our stories are there. They're in our psyche, they're in our blood, they're in the water. But they're not out there easily accessible. And I think that we as writers have a responsibility to look at what history we've got. Are we perpetuating a story that was told by the conqueror? An example is that the story of Ariadne in Crete. She is the goddess incarnate. She holds the space for Theseus to go into the labyrinth, into meet his acknowledge, his minotaur. And that is about a self of healing. The Greek, the Mycenaean, when they came over, they relegated Ariadne to be a daughter, to be a princess, to be a maiden. She lost her power. And this is what we find with a lot of our myths, is that they are the voice of the conqueror. So do I purposely go and want to write something? You are absolutely spot on, sister. That's something I think is very important. And that's why when I come across this story, the history of the Minoans, it's like, oh my God, it was a revelation. And the fact that they were the most advanced civilization in the Bronze Age, there's even evidence that they were tin mining up in America, Michigan Island. There's evidence of Minoans up there as well as Ireland. Absolutely.
I don't know about that, but I can tell you my research.
So
I'll take your word.
You've got this most advanced civilization of the Bronze Age, and they had no weapons of war. They had human sacrifice. Fine. No weapons of war. So why don't we know this? Why have this been lost? Why do I need to go deep diving? And you yourself, I don't know this. Why not? This is women's stories. So now you know it. And through my stories, I'm hoping to build on that more. And I think that was with the story of the python, that oh my goodness, that was like so many stories. I was trying to work out who's who in this zoo. You know, there's a python, there's a delphine, there's another one, I can't pronounce her name, like a draconia or something like this. There's all this sort of stuff. Python is male, python is male, python is female. Like, it's all very, very cloudy. So
no wonder Greece is an inspiration for you, because there is so many stories and so many versions of the story, so many versions of the of a myth, so many versions of the mythology that we maybe learn at school. Yeah, now I can see actually the answer to my previous question. So what's happening, what's going to happen to Cressida now? Should we be expecting a third novel, a trilogy?
It's. I do know you like trilogies.
I do. Guilty as charged.
I had a little poke. There was a little poke somewhere that there is when you look at Cressida's story and she is pregnant again, and that is when she, I don't want to say too much because spoiler alert, but she is pregnant, and she's pregnant with a girl, and she helps save the world. So what implications does this have? Where does the child go? I don't know, and I'm not in a position at this moment to actually dig into that. But there's just that glimmer that if there was to be a story, that would be her story. And so Cressida would step back. Cressida's healed. Cressida knows who she is, which is written on the Temple of Apollo. Know thyself.
Know thyself. Yes.
Everything in moderation, know thyself. They're the only two I know. I think there were about 38 or something of them, or the 27 of them. There's a whole heap. They're the only two we really know. But that whole sense of know thyself is it's so deep and pure, and it's hard work to get there. And that's what, and you have to feel your feelings, everything you push away, everything you is too hard, those emotions that hurt, they're what you need to actually, they're your minotaur. You need to sit in your feelings. And Cressida is able to do that, mind you, with the help of the gods and the goddesses, but she has the courage to do that. So her story is told, really. Or maybe not. Who knows? Maybe I'll come back in 5 years and we'll have another chat and it'll be book three.
Absolutely. Why not? Why not? Karen Martin, thank you very much for today. Good luck with the launch of the book of Delphi, and good luck with the third book about Cressida and her journey, her life journey.
Thank you, Dina. And look, if people are wanting to get Delphi, they can either you can purchase it online through Amazon, either as an ebook or paperback, or you can just go into your local bookshop and ask them to order it in. That's possible too.
Θέλετε να ακούσετε περισσότερες ιστορίες σαν και αυτήν? Ακούστε στο Apple Podcast, στο Google Podcast, στο Spotify ή οπουδήποτε ακούτε podcast.